I listened to all that was said about it, very much fearing that I should not be permitted to do the coveted work. For the feeling had already frequently come to me that I was the one too many in the overcrowded family nest. Once, before we left our old home, I had heard a neighbor condoling with my mother because there were so many of us, and her empathic reply had been a great relief to my mind. "There isn't one more than I want. I could not spare a single one of my children." But her difficulties were increasing, and I thought it would be a pleasure to feel that I was not a trouble or burden or expense to anybody. So I went to my first day's work in the mill with a light heart. The novelty of it made it seem easy, and it really was not hard, just to change the bobbins on the spinning frames every 3/4 of an hour or so, with 6 other little girls who were doing the same thing. When I came back at night, the family began to pity me for my long, tiresome day's work, but I laughed and said, "Why, it is nothing but fun. It is just like play." And for a little while, it was only a new amusement. I liked it better than going to school and making believe I was learning when I was not. And there was a great deal of play mixed with it. We were not occupied more than half the time. The intervals were spent frolicking around the spinning frames, teasing and talking to the older girls, or entertaining ourselves with the games and stories in a corner, or exploring with the overseer's permission the mysteries of the carding room, the dressing room, and the weaving room. I never cared much for machinery. The buzzing and hissing and whizzing of pulleys and rollers and spindles and flyers around me often grew tiresome. I could not see into their complications or feel interested in them. But in a room below us, we were sometimes allowed to peer in through a sort of blind door at the great water wheel that carried the works of the whole mill. It was so huge that we could only watch a few of its spokes at a time, and part of its dripping rim moving with a slow, measured strength through the darkness that shut it in. It impressed me with something of the awe which comes to us in thinking of the great power which keeps the mechanism of the universe in motion. Even now, the remembrance of its large, mysterious movement, in which every little motion of every noisy little wheel was involved, brings back to me a verse from one of my favorite hymns. "Our lives through various scenes are drawn and vexed by trifling cares, while thine eternal thought moves on thy undisturbed affairs." There were compensations for being shut in to daily toil so early. The mill itself had its lessons for us, but it was not, and could not be, the right sort of life for a child, and we were happy in the knowledge that, at the longest, our employment was only to be temporary. When I took my next 3 months at the grammar school, everything there was changed, and I, too, was changed. The teachers were kind and thorough in their instruction, and my mind seemed to have been plowed up during that year of work, so that knowledge took root in it easily. It was a great delight to me to study, and at the end of the 3 months the master told me that I was prepared for the high school. But alas, I could not go. The little money that I could earn, $1 a week, besides the price of my board, was needed in the family, and I must return to the mill. It was a severe disappointment to me, though I did not say so at home. I did not at all accept the conclusion of a neighbor whom I heard talking about it with my mother. His daughter was going to the high school, and my mother was telling him how sorry she was that I could not.
"Oh," he said in a soothing tone, "my girl hasn't got any such headpiece as yours has. Your girl doesn't need to go."
Of course, I knew that whatever sort of a headpiece I had, I did need and want just that very opportunity to study. I think the solution was then formed inwardly that I would go to school again sometime, whatever happened. I went back to my work, but now without enthusiasm. I had looked through an open door that I was not willing to see shut upon me. I began to reflect upon life rather seriously for a girl of 12 or 13. What was I here for? What could I make of myself? Must I submit to be carried along with the current and do just what everybody else did? No. I knew I should not do that, for there was a certain myself who was always starting up with her own original plan or aspiration before me, and who was quite indifferent as to what people generally thought. Well, I would find out what this myself was good for, and that she should be. It was but the presumption of extreme youth. How gladly would I know now, after these long years, just why I was sent into the world, and whether I have in any degree fulfilled the purpose of my being. In the older times it was seldom said to little girls, as it always has been said to boys, that they ought to have some definite plan, while they were children, what to be and do when they were grown up. There was usually but one path open before them to become good wives and housekeepers, and the ambition of most girls was to follow their mother's footsteps in this direction, a natural and laudable ambition. But girls, as well as boys, must often have been conscious of their own peculiar capabilities, must have desired to cultivate and make use of their individual powers. When I was growing up, they had already begun to be encouraged to do so. We were often told that it was our duty to develop any talent we might possess, or at least to learn how to do some one thing which the world needed, or which would make it a pleasanter world. When I thought what I should best like to do, my first dream, almost a baby's dream, about it was that it would be a fine thing to be a school teacher like Aunt Hannah. Afterward, when I heard that there were artists, I wish I could sometime be one. A slate and pencil to draw pictures was my first request whenever a day's ailment kept me at home from school. And I rather enjoyed being a little ill for the sake of amusing myself in that way. The wish grew up with me, but there were no good drawing teachers in those days, and if there had been, the cost of instruction would have been beyond the family means. My sister Emily, however, who saw my taste and shared it herself, did her best to assist me, furnishing me with pencil and paper and paint-box. If I could only make a rose bloom on paper, I thought I should be happy. Or if I could at least succeed in drawing the outline of winter-stripped boughs as I saw them against the sky, it seemed to me that I should be willing to spend years in trying. I did try a little, and often. Jack Frost was my most inspiring teacher. His skeletons on the bedroom window pane in cold mornings were my ideal studies of Swiss scenery, crags and peaks and chalets and fir trees, and graceful tracery of ferns, like those that grew in the woods where we went huckleberrying, all blended together by his touch of enchantment. I wondered whether human fingers ever succeeded in imitating that lovely work. The taste has followed me all my life through, but I could never indulge it except as a recreation. I was not to be an artist, and I am rather glad that I was hindered, for I had even stronger inclinations in other directions, and art, really noble art, requires the entire devotion of a lifetime. I seldom thought seriously of becoming an author, although it seemed to me that anybody who had written a book would have a right to feel very proud. But I believe that a person must be exceedingly wise before presuming to attempt it, although now and then I thought I could feel ideas growing in my mind that it might be worthwhile to put into a book, if I lived and studied until I was 40 or 50 years old. I wrote my little verses, to be sure, but that was nothing, they just grew. They were the same as breathing or singing. I could not help writing them, and I thought and dreamed a great many that were ever put on paper. They seemed to fly into my mind and away again like birds with a carol through the air. It seemed strange to me that people should notice them, or should think my writing verses anything peculiar, for I supposed that they were in everybody's mind, just as they were in mine, and that anybody could write them who chose. One day I heard a relative say to my mother, "Keep what she writes till she grows up, and perhaps she will get money for it. I have heard of somebody who earned $1,000 by writing poetry." It sounded so absurd to me. Money for writing verses? $1 would be as ridiculous as $1,000. I should as soon have thought of being paid for thinking. My mother, fortunately, was sensible enough never to flatter me or let me be flattered about my scribbling. It never was allowed to hinder any work I had to do. I crept away into a corner to write what came into my head, just as I ran away to play, and I looked upon it only as my most agreeable amusement, never thinking of preserving anything which did not of itself stay in my memory. This, too, was well, for the time did not come when I could afford to look upon verse-writing as an occupation. Through my life it has only been permitted to me as an aside from other more pressing employments. Whether I should have written better verses had circumstances left me free to do what I chose, it is impossible now to know. All my thoughts about my future sent me back to Aunt Hannah and my first infantile idea of being a teacher. I foresaw that I should be that before I could be or do anything else. It had been impressed upon me that I must make myself useful in the world, and certainly one could be useful who could keep school as Aunt Hannah did. I did not see anything else for a girl to do who wanted to use her brains as well as her hands. So the plan of preparing myself to be a teacher gradually and almost unconsciously shaped itself in my mind as the only practicable one. I could earn my living in that way, all important consideration. I liked the thought of self-support, but I would have chosen some artistic or beautiful work if I could. I had no especial aptitude for teaching and no absorbing wish to be a teacher, but it seemed to me that I might succeed if I tried. What I did like about it was that one must know something first. I must acquire knowledge before I could impart it, and that was just what I wanted. I could be a student wherever I was and whatever else I had to be or do, and I would. I knew I should write. I could not help doing that, for my hand seemed instinctively to move toward pen and paper in moments of leisure. But to write anything worthwhile, I must have mental cultivation. So, in preparing myself to teach, I could also be preparing myself to write. This was the plan that indefinitely shaped itself in my mind as I returned to my work in the spinning room, and which I followed out, not without many breaks and hindrances and neglects, during the next 6 or 7 years, to learn all I could so that I should be fit to teach or to write as the way opened. And it turned out that 15 or 20 of my best years were given to teaching.